Discovery 2, Lecture 5, Part 3, and part of Lecture 6. Now, as a special treat today, we're having a guest lecturer from Chitaway Bay in New South Wales, Mr. Dean Adams. And he will be doing today's lecture, and I will be following along with my book, making little Tinkerbell tinkly noises, like an original little long playing record, whenever we have to turn the page. But he's actually doing
very
the
long playing.
Very long playing record. And we will be doing the we'll be doing those chapters today, and Dean will be doing that, and just for a bit of fun. So that'll be exciting, and I get to sort of take it easy. Okay, a couple of general announcements on the recording before we get started. If you haven't installed TerraTerm Pro by now, naughty. Smacks and tears. We really need to see that getting installed. TerraTerm Pro is very important. You should know how to use it. Or if you're using a Mac or something, you should know how to use Telnet at your command prompt or whatever to get into the remote bundle. All students should have at least tried to connect to the remote bundle on cavibundle.ath.cx by now. If you haven't, not very happy, guys. We're running out of time. There is a lot of labs that you need to do. Okay, speaking of labs, two exciting things have happened. Students have heard the call, and they have put in the hard yards and avoided cliches like the plague. And two things have happened. We have all 48 labs for IT Essentials in text files up on qcat.org, and that is in ITE2 in the manuals folder, which is where I think it should be. But if anybody disagrees, feel free to correct me.
Thank you, Elise Lonsdale.
Thank you, Elise Lonsdale, and William Taylor.
Oh, yes, and Mr. Taylor.
Yes, it's all been a good effort.
Very happy about that. Okay, the second thing that's happened is, Mr. Dean, I've got so much time on my hands and I want to use it for Cavi because I'm a nice bloke, Adams, has sat down and extracted all of the labs into Word documents for Discovery 2. And he's already been given a little present that he will enjoy.
Mr. Adams, good one.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Adams.
Yeah, took me all day yesterday to do that.
Thanks, Dean. That's been great.
And that will go up after lecture, and I will put that up so that everybody has access to those documents. Now, some of those labs are not accessible at this stage, and there will be modifications made, but those that are accessible, you are expected to do on the remote bundle. So if you haven't connected to the remote bundle yet, I think we get the idea, don't we? You've really got to try connecting to that remote bundle and get used to it. Now, speaking of that, we have updated documentation on the QCAT website. I don't know whether anybody noticed, but the TerraTerm notes, which can be found, I believe, in Discovery 2, and they can also be found in... I've got to double-check that, but I'm pretty sure they are in Discovery 2. You can actually... they've been significantly updated. So there's actually 7K of documentation, and it even goes through how to compile the JAWS script. So, we've also updated the accessing the remote bundle documentation. Gemma has converted that into HTML with anchors and heading jumps. So, thank you, Gemma.
Is that currently available for download, or are we waiting?
Yes, it's up on the site already.
Yeah, no, that's very good too. I like it, that format much better.
Is Gemma's microphone working?
Probably Discovery. Cause I'm going to download that copy now. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Okay, well, we're just saying thank you, Gemma, for HTMLizing that document, and you'll keep that up to date as the weeks go on if we need to make modifications to it. Also, the VMware instructions.html has also been HTMLified, and that was also a Gemma effort. That's not to say that Gemma has the monopoly on HTMLizing documents. If any other students want to convert them into HTML, I'm staring very hard at you, Elise, there, in case you feel the urge that something... It should be in
like
HTML.
What would you
No.
Anchors and stuff.
If you think there's a document that's in text files and that's a bit flat and boring and you'd like to mark it up, feel free to do so. If you don't, that's okay too. But just if you see something. Okay. Now, I think that's everything. We probably should mention that the minister that came out on Wednesday didn't end up getting in at all, so... It was nice to meet him, but he's not in the cabinet.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
And I don't think we'll get any tomatoes, sausage rolls either, but you live in hope. Well, yeah, they're peach chewies. Okay, just for people who wanted to know what they were. So that's all good. All right, look, I'm handing it over to you, Mr. Da-da-da-dum. Da-da-da-dum. And you can start on the lecture.
That's funny, that isn't it? Did you just want to finish off that Module 5 little bit, and then I'll do the Module 6?
I thought I did the Module 5 little bit last week, actually. Okay. I got as far as the login banners, I think. I talked about login banners last week. There are two banners. One is the message of the day, and I'm doing this from memory, by the way, because I haven't actually opened the notes yet. I was hoping you were going to start, and then I was going to open the notes and catch up, but that's not going to happen, so we'll do that from memory. Login banners is the one that shows up when you first connect to the router, and the message of the day banner is the one that shows up once you have logged in. We all remember that from last week?
That we do, thank you.
And when you set up a message of the day banner, you go. You basically have a delimiting character, so you go banner, MOTD, caret, yada, 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 caret. And the reason you've got the carets on either side to actually delimit the banner is so that you can have carriage returns in the banner. But once you've done the hands-on lab on that, that'll make a lot more sense. And this goes for the whole of Discovery. Once you actually do the hands-on labs, the stuff that you thought you understood by reading the notes will actually become more cemented in your head, and you'll understand how that all works. Okay, so you've got your... Now, the other thing they talk about is you can configure the routers with SDM, which is the Cisco something, device manager, I think it stands for. I'm not quite sure on that.
Security device manager, Kerry.
Ah, thank you. Anyway, I haven't actually tried using that, but it's not particularly accessible as far as I can tell, so you'd be better to do it from the command line. You've certainly got more control, but it does talk about both ways of setting up a router configuration. You can set up simple configurations with the SDM, which is essentially what Marky Mark does, Elise, and I'm sure you know who I mean by Marky Mark.
Affirmative.
Or you can actually do these things from the command line. Now, sometimes it's harder to do it from the command line because you actually have to have more expertise and you actually need to know what's going on, but that's because you're a CAVI student and you will know what's going on. We don't have any high expectations of you or anything, do we? No. It talks about setting up NAT, which is Network Address Translation, and it talks about setting up static NAT and dynamic NAT. Static NAT maps an external IP address on the internet to an internal address on your LAN. 1-to-1 mapping. Static NAT is 1-to-1 mapping. One internal address to one external address. Hey, we forgot to move into the lecture theatre. Don't suppose it matters.
Do you want to?
No, it's alright. We'll stay here. Okay, one internal to one external. Static NAT. Dynamic NAT is, and Cisco calls this overloading, because it overloads one external IP address with lots of internal IP addresses. Can anybody tell me what device usually performs overload network address translation? What type of device that lots of people have?
Router?
Everyone's ADSL router.
Yes, something like a Billion or a Netgear or one of those little home ADSL routers.
The usual ones,
yeah. Okay. Does anybody... And does anybody know one of the problems with network address translation?
Is it because if you don't have a static IP address, you can't have like port forwarding or anything like that?
Hang on. We're having a problem where... No. We're having a problem with Ventrilo. It's squawking that duplicate names aren't allowed on the network. I know. Chris has set his up for Jake.
Somebody's got two computers with the same name.
Chris, smack, will you please put things back when you set them? We need to set that back up to Jake. So change the username to Jake. We can't have two Chris legs logged on at once.
Just think of what that would do to the donut economy if you did.
Yeah, he is on there.
Yes, there's one Chris leg at the top of the list.
Okay.
You could always just set up as Cavi.
I think it chucks the first one off if you do get it to work. I think I accidentally came on with my laptop one day and it chucked off Firebolt and let the laptop on or something.
Yeah, now what's happened is you can't easily have two users on at once. Leave that one. Okay. Okay, we're just sorting things out here. There we are. Yes, so one-to-one, sorry, the problem with network address translation, Dean did give me an answer, and he was sort of right. If you've got a dynamic address, your address changes. Can anybody tell me, and this really isn't in the notes, but we talk about it because lots of people want to know anyway. Can anybody tell me what you can do if you have a dynamic address so that people can find your home machine when it connects to the internet?
Dynamic DNS?
Yep. We're not sure why, but that one won't actually connect, so I'll go and have a look later, because I think it's got to have its information rekeyed in, but it's complaining about duplicate names again, even though we've changed it over to Jake.
Okay, have you just logged it off now?
Yeah. Look, I've got to go in and actually press buttons on it, Chris. I don't know what's going on. I mean, Sue did click the username button, but I've probably got to go in and hammer the profiles in. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for that.
I think you can't just change the name. You've got to actually create a different user. That's just a guess.
It's got multiple users already on there. Yeah, it's already set up.
Okay.
It's a moot point, guys. We'll sort it later. It's not a problem. Glenn's going to log in from his, so that won't be a problem. Probably already has. But please, and Chris, you've really got to put things back when you mess with them, because otherwise you won't get on. It's very important when we all work in the lab, and this goes for everyone, that if you make a change to something, put it back when you go. I know it's hard to remember to do, but it does cause us a bit of grief when lectures get underway. So, there we go.
Sorry about that. We'll do it next time.
Yeah. Otherwise, use a different, we can always create you a different Cisco account, and you can come in under that. So if you want all your settings to stick and stay, that way it might keep it separate from the Ventrilo. I think Ventrilo keeps the different user accounts separate under the different profiles, I think. Okay, so one-to-one, okay, so dynamic DNS, and an example of a dynamic DNS provider is dyndns.org. Or, what's another one? no-ip.com, or... DHS.org is another one. There's quite a number of them you can Google up for dynamic DNS. What I was actually going to say is, if you overload the internal IP address and map multiple internal IP addresses to an external IP address, you no longer have end-to-end connectivity as far as the internet's concerned for all of the internal address hosts. Therefore, you need to put in PATs, or port address translations, which allow incoming ports on the external address to be mapped onto incoming ports on the internal address. Can anybody give me an example where a port mapping, a 100% legal example at the moment, of where a port mapping would be essential if you have a NAT that overloads?
Skype?
It's not required, but it's a good idea. Different example?
Or UTorrent?
No, I was talking about legal still, but yeah, UTorrent is a...
Well,
well, it depends what you're downloading, but yeah, UTorrent. I was thinking voice over IP. Your VoIP won't ring unless you map 5063.
Right, unless you forgot about that. Yeah, very true.
And in fact, if you've got a billion router, a billion actually eats traffic to anything on 5060, so you've actually got to put your VoIP box on a different port.
Yeah, it's got to be on 5070.
Otherwise, the billion eats the traffic, which is interesting.
That's curious.
I was told that the billion blocked port 5060 in their firmware.
What they actually do is they actually have a listening process that automatically listens on 5060 for some reason, whether or not it's a VoIP router. On a VoIP router, that's what you want it to do, listen on 5060, because it's up to the router to handle the VoIP. But if it's not a VoIP router, they do have an open socket on 5060. I actually found a way around that on my 7404 VGO, but that was actually changing the interface that the VoIP bound to. I didn't find a way around it on the 7300.
No, worked okay on port 5070 anyway, and 16384 to 2384, but you could narrow it down to 16384 to 16484.
You can actually narrow it down to 16384 to 16392. You only actually need eight contiguous ports.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'll email you the document. I've actually got the manual for the Sapura SPA 3000, and that's relevant for the 3000, the 3102, and a couple of the other models, and it's the manual that you never ever get given by anybody, but it's got all the different configuration parameters and what they all mean, because I'm sure your box is unlocked now, isn't it, Dean?
Yeah, no, it has been for quite a while now. It's very good. I've done some, a few little hiccups, but overall it's been very good.
Well, what you can actually do with your box, and we won't talk about this too much today, but talk to Elise and Craig and Will, you can actually do direct IP dialing. So you can actually bypass the voice provider and go 203.101.161.89*5060#, and you can actually dial without using FactorTel at all.
So you can, and it works quite nicely. So my netcom at the moment seems to be blocking inbound ones for some reason. I don't know why they can't ring in, but yeah, it sort of worked better on the billion, funnily enough, than it's doing on the netcom.
Make sure you change your VoIP port to be something other than 5060. Change it to 5070, and then redirect port 5070 in, because I found on the billion, even if you put an inbound port redirect, it still ate the traffic on 5060.
Yeah, well, I'm using the netcom now, so...
Okay, so port forwards are important if you're using overloaded network address translation. Okay, so that's good. You can configure the network address translation either from the SDM, Security Device Manager, or you can do it from the CLI. You need to specify the external IP address that you're going to NAT with, or the external address pool. You need to specify the internal network network that you're going to NAT, and then you actually set up a little access control list to map onto which interface the NAT is going to take place, and that will be found in the dynamic lab, labs that are present in Chapter 5, the hands-on lab. We are working as hard as we can to build the new Eagle server discovery bundle thing. However, we've found out that the rack we've got needs rails, and the rails are more expensive than the servers. Gotta love rack mount gear. DHCP can be configured either by SDM, or it can be configured on a particular router. One of the things you have to do if you're configuring DHCP is you have to tell it which network it has to DHCP for, which range of IP addresses it is going to hand out, the default lease time, and then you tell it the DHCP server to start. And usually IP addresses are leased for one day by default, and you can either do that from SDM or from the command line. I think that's about it for Chapter 5, to be honest.
There's only just a little bit on switches in the last section.
Okay, I do have that somewhere. Ah, yes, that's right, I remember now. If you've got a Cisco switch, I can't remember the model number, but we've got some sitting up on top of the thing, 3820s or something. You basically have N number of ports, in other words, you know, 8, 16, 24. And then you look at having... a switch, if it wants to be managed using TCP/IP, you actually need to configure VLAN 1, which is the administrative VLAN, with an IP address. And once you configure VLAN 1 with an IP address, you can then telnet to the switch, and that's quite handy. If you don't configure the switch with an IP address, i.e. you don't assign an IP address to VLAN 1, you have to manage the switch through the console port with a serial cable. Hey, I tell you what else is good value for money, and we really shouldn't be trying to sell products here, but on oztechnologies.com, there are some 8-port gigabit Linksys switches that have actually got simple management on them, and you can set up VLANs and all sorts of things. Anyone know what a VLAN is?
Isn't it so you can separate each of the ports into for different IP address ranges?
Virtual networks.
Virtual local area networks is what actual a VLAN is, and what you actually do is you tag the packets with a number from 1 to 4094 and you assign a certain set of ports to a particular VLAN. So what you can have is you can have ports 1, 3 and 5 as part of VLAN 4, and you can have ports 2, 4 and 8 as parts of VLAN 10, and it actually splits the network into the switch into two completely separate collision domains. And the networks will not see any traffic from each other.
Cool.
And it doesn't matter what IP addresses you use, because this this actual fragmentation occurs at layer 2.
Layer 2, yeah.
I'm not I'm not going to go into what happens when you tag or don't tag packets, but essentially if you have packets that are tagged, which means they contain the VLAN information in them, you can actually have packets travelling across VLANs between multiple switches. But often the network cards that you have in computers in the old days never used to be able to understand VLANs, therefore you would actually tell the switch to remove the VLAN tagging from the frames before they were sent to the computers. Although I don't know whether it's just me, but if you've looked in your advanced properties of your network card, which of course you all have because you're CAVI students, haven't we? We've all been into the advanced and had a look at all the little advanced properties you can set. One of them is the VLAN ID. So you can actually set which VLAN your PC exists on, and that's true for the PCI Express Realtek cards and the Intel cards. And in fact, the Intel cards have supported VLANs for quite some time, and Linux has certainly supported VLANs for quite some time on most network hardware.
My card's a 2002 vintage IBM. Would it support it?
Don't know. You'd have to look at the. You'd have to look at the. Yeah, yeah. What brand is it? Is it actually an IBM network card or?
I believe it is. Hang on, I'll check.
So there you go. Don't go changing your VLAN ID, or it'll knock you off Ventrilo. Keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Also, the billions support VLAN, so even though they've only got four ports on them, you can actually put each port in a separate VLAN and connect different switches to the VLANs, and those networks will not see each other. So that's essentially how VLANs work.
An IBM Infinity 10100 Ethernet adapter?
Probably not, but I'd be interested to know whether it does. I think that essentially covers the switch bits, but essentially you can get in and you can configure the switch and you can set the host name and you can... it talks about a whole lot of stuff that you're really going to have to read through and understand in those notes. You can put ports into what we call secure mode, which means that the port will only handle having one MAC address connected to each port. And if the port is in secure mode and you actually do that binding, if one machine connects onto that port and then you go and disconnect it and connect another machine onto that port, there'll actually be a security lockout and the port will be disabled. You can either have the addresses being unsecured, sticky, or static. Now, static means that they actually get stored in the configuration on the switch. And sticky means that the port looks for the first MAC address and then remembers it. And it basically goes through how you've actually got to turn off port-based security on a certain port and then turn it back on to reset the port. No, that's all right. Or you can reset the port and various things like that, and, you know, shut it down and bring it back up again. Very important that you understand the idiosyncrasies of port-based security if you're going to turn it on, and you will get a chance to play with this when the new Eagle bundle is installed. You can play with this stuff on the switch bundle of the remote bundle, but the switches are... the switches are the right model, but you will have to read the accessing the remote bundle documentation to know how to access the switch bundle if you want to play with that particular stuff. Any questions? Hello, Mr. Adams. I'm surprised you're on this morning.
Yeah, right.
Did TAFE explode or something? Sorry?
Online course now at TAFE, so I was able to leave early, and it being Pirate Day, I thought I'd show my face.
Oh, well, we certainly can't see it from here. I suppose that's potentially a good thing. No, just kidding. And yes, I saw your labs for Module 1. I haven't marked them yet, but they're in my inbox.
So we've got two Mr. Adamses now.
We do.
What a scary thought.
We have Herberticus and Denicus. I must say,
I've never had too many drinks.
I like Herbert Adams pies, actually.
I don't think they're still around, though.
Yeah, they are.
Is it just me, or do the two Adamses sound very much alike?
No, they do sound different.
Don't you hear an ate up a bit?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so now I hand over to Mr. Dean, who's going to take over the lecture from this point on, because I think I've covered most of the stuff in 5, and I bet you half you haven't even read Chapter 5 yet, but that's just me. So let's see how many of you have, and... we'll hopefully get some questions next week on what might have been in Chapter 5.
Okay, we're right, Gary. Off and running.
Yeah, you're right. We've been recording for ages, so you're right.
Yep. Okay, now into Module 6, and it covers enabling routing protocols. In the first section, it's routing basics. As the internal network of an organization grows, it may be necessary to break up a network into multiple smaller networks for security or organizational purpose. So you want to separate, say, your accounting and sales sections in a company into different subnets. The division is often accomplished by subnetting the network. Subnetting requires a router to pass traffic from one subnet to another.
Okay, question. What layer is that separation occurring at?
Layer 3.
That is correct. That separation is occurring at layer 3. We are subnetting, therefore we are doing the separation at layer 3. Sorry, just putting in some padding there, Dean, to let you read a few more notes.
Yep, that's a good thing. It's got to stick in my head first. Okay, moving on. To direct messages across the networks so that they can arrive at the correct destination, a router uses a table containing all of the locally connected networks.
Okay, now while you're catching up, I was just going to say...
Yeah, go on.
Yep.
Is that referred to as an IP table?
It's referred to a routing table.
Thanks, guys.
Don't confuse IP tables, which is a Linux utility, with routing tables. Now, a little exercise for you all to do, just because this is going to be a really interactive lecture today. I want you all to crack open a command prompt, and I should be able to hear the cracks from here. And I want you to type in route space print and have a look at the output.
There it is.
Okay, for example, I've got a route that says 0.0.0.0, 0.0.0.0, 192.168.100.10. That means that the source is 0.0.0.0, the mask is 0.0.0.0, and the IP address it's going to route to is 192.168.100.10. Can anybody apart from Dean and Gemma tell me which route that is? What's special about that route?
Default route.
Which is what when it's at home?
Internet.
Not necessarily, no.
Anything outside your network, your local network.
Question?
Yes, Mr. Legg, you are correct. Anything outside your local network. Very important, the default route does not have to point at the internet. There is no reason why that has to be the case. It may point somewhere else. Yes?
Well, are we talking about the subnet?
Sorry, Elise?
With your question, are we talking about the actual, the first entry in each of these five columns?
Okay, there are five columns.
Yep.
The first column is the network, which is the network address of the route. Now, I was talking specifically about the very left-hand column here, and the network address there was 0.0.0.0, which is the default route.
As is mine.
But you could have a network address of 192.168.1.0, which could be the network that you're on.
Third row down, actually.
And the next one is the mask of that route. Now, remember, the network address, the network address is ANDed with the mask, and we find out whether the route exists on that subnet or not. Sorry, I've short-circuited a small portion of your notes here, Dean, and I'll be finished in a minute, because I know you do cover that in a second. The destination is where the route is going to go to. Now, under Windows, that's the IP address of the interface that the route is actually going to go through, whereas in Linux it can actually be either the interface or it can be it can also be the gateway that it's going to be forwarded through, and that's also true for Windows.
Yes, because the second,
routers,
the third
isn't
column
it,
is headed
either
gateway.
The device or the next hop address, isn't it?
That's right. The route can either point at the next hop address or it can point at the device. And in fact, you'll see that there's actually a gateway column or there's actually a device column. Now, if it's going to be the device column, you'll see the name of the device that the route is pointing through and you'll see the IP address of the that is bound to the current interface. So if the device is Realtek Gigabit, mine would say 192.168.100.62 in the destination field because that's where the packet is going to come from.
Yep.
And the metric is the cost of the route. In other words, how expensive it is to send information over that route, higher or lower. The higher the cost, the more expensive it is to send it over the route, and Dean will say a lot more about that. Okay, sorry, I've finished now, but I thought that was a good way of people seeing a routing table.
Yeah, no, it's a good idea. Okay. A router uses a table containing all the locally connected networks and the interfaces that are connected to each network. Each interface belongs to a different IP network. A router determines which route or path to use by looking up the information stored in the routing table. The routing table also contains information about routes that the router can use to each remote networks which are not locally attached.
Okay. I just want to point out here. Yeah, wait a second. Anybody who's got a Linux box can also log into their Linux box and type, either if you're not the super user or if you're running Red Hat, /sbin/route, or you can be the super user and type route, assuming you've got sbin in your path, or if you are using the newer utilities, say, for example, you're using Ubuntu and you've got the new tools installed, you can go ip:route:show. So there's another advantage, another example of routing tables.
Just one that I was just logging into my machine as you were, and I had Jawsbury at Jabber over the top of you. What was that last one if you logged in as a super user? Sorry, Kerry?
Should just be able to type route.
Yep, there it is.
Did that work for you?
Yep, just type route, no route printer in there, that sort of stuff.
That's right.
Gateway, what else have I got here?
Now, if you don't want it to resolve any of the target IP addresses, you can go /route:n, which will stop it from resolving the target IP addresses, which if your DNS is running like a snail on downers, that will make the output a lot quicker.
Yep, thanks.
Okay, back to you, Dean.
Okay. Routes can be statically assigned by the router by an administrator, or the routes can be dynamically given by the router by another router via routing protocol. A router uses a routing table to determine where to send the packets. The routing table can be set of routes. Each route describes which gateway or interface the router uses to reach a specified network. A route has four main components: destination value, a subnet mask, a gateway or interface address, route cost or metric, which Kerry mentioned earlier. When a router receives a packet, the router examines the destination IP address in the packet to determine where to forward the packet. The router then looks for a matching destination value in the routing table. Each destination value within the route table refers to a destination network address. The destination IP address within the packet, however, consists of both a network address and a host address. For the router to determine if its table contains a route to the destination network, it must determine there is a match between the IP address and the one of the destination values in the routing table. This means that the router must determine which bits of the IP address represent the network and which bits represent the host. The router looks up the subnet mask assigned to each potential route in the table. The router applies each subnet mask to the destination IP address in the packet. The resulting network address is then compared to the network address of the route in the table. If a match is found, the packet is forwarded out of the correct interface or to the appropriate gateway. If the network address matches more than one route in the table, the router uses the route that has the most specific or longest network address match. Sometimes there is more than one route to the destination. In this case, routing protocols rules determine which route the router uses. is none of the route entries match, the router directs the message to the gateway specified in the default route. If a default route is configured, otherwise the packet is simply dropped.
Okay, that's important. You really have to make sure that there are routes for the destinations you want to send to. If you don't, then you're going to find that the packets are just going to be dropped with no reason as to why they're going to be dropped. And a lot of people actually set up two subnets at home, and they go, I don't trust housemate, so I'll have one subnet and they'll have one subnet, and then they can't figure out why they can't get packets between the two subnets because they didn't tell the router about both subnets.
Just a simple question for everyone. Why would you assign a static IP address to a device or server?
Oh, I do it for a number of reasons. If I want to know where my resources are on the network, I might be accessing something like VNC in the internal network here, I want to just log directly to a machine. And I just don't want them wandering around all over the place.
Can we have a few answers from someone else as well, please?
So you know where to find it when you're trying to log in and configure it, or if you need to access any of its services, you can just put the IP in and know that it's going to be there all the time.
Yep, that's very good. Anybody else?
Just making sure, if you've got any torrents running there, Chris, shut them down. You're breaking up.
None running, but we have been having some network issues lately, and I've had to unplug the QoS thing, so that might be affecting it. I'll kick everyone else off, whatever they're downloading, though.
Yeah, rip Stephen's cable out. That should solve your problem. Okay. Now, that's a valid question. That's a valid answer. You can do all this with dynamic DNS, though. What if you had a dynamic DNS and you had all the machines that were coming up with dynamic addresses registering themselves in dynamic DNS? That would work too. So why would you have static addresses on things?
In case your DNS goes down or your DHCP goes down, you've got the static IP, so you can still access it without having to rely on other services.
That's right. And the other thing is, if you've got routers that don't remember their DHCP table when you reboot them, devices are liable to move around. If you're using Linux as your DHCP server, and I'm staring at Elise here who will get around to this one day, once a DHCP address is assigned, it won't change because it's actually stored in Elise database. DHCP actually stands for Dynamic Host Control Protocol. And it means you can actually static things down in the DHCP server. The other thing you can do, which a lot of people don't know about, has anybody ever seen the tab under...
No, you go ahead with your bit, then I'll ask my question. I don't want to interrupt.
Has anybody seen the bit in Windows where you can actually go into the IP address settings and you can actually set up an alternate configuration?
Yeah, you made me do that.
Yeah, I make you do lots of things. You can actually set up an alternate configuration so that if DHCP fails, then the stuff will turn up on the same IP address regardless. So what usually happens, the default for Windows is the primary configuration is... Okay, and the primary configuration is DHCP. Can anybody tell me what the default alternate configuration is?
A PIPA.
That's right. So anybody remember what...
The alternative will only be used if the primary one doesn't work for some reason.
That's right. The other thing you can do is if you actually modify the alternate configuration and change it from a PIPA to something else, you can actually have a fallback static address for when the DHCP server is unavailable. Now, the other command I'd suggest everybody have a look at, and I think I told Dean about it last year, and I certainly mentioned it last year, go and Google up a command called netsh. It's extremely powerful, and I'm going to say no more about it. But suffice it to say, it can save and restore all of your Windows network settings if you want it to.
Can I run it and just get some help on it from the command line?
You certainly can. The most useful commands you'll have are netsh dump and netsh exec, but netsh help will give you all sorts of help that will look extremely cryptic until you Google up a tutorial article, but you certainly can get help out of it.
Just making myself a little bit of homework to do.
And
your statement was?
Yes, what was your question, Elise? Sorry, we had a pending question from Elise.
Well, we did. You were talking about the DHL. Now, I'm glad you mentioned this, because I did discuss it with Mr. Craig. The reason I've not set up DHCP on my Linux server is, what if my Linux server goes down? Which I think you've just sort of answered it by setting up the secondary settings, which I didn't know about until this lecture. And the other question was, given my router runs BusyBox, could I do it on that if I telnet in there? Just your thoughts.
It's still only, the router doesn't store the tables in flash memory, it only stores it in RAM. So as soon as you turn off the router, gone.
Yep, you'll lose it. Yep, fine.
The other question I have for you, Elise, is, so, okay, so if your Linux server goes down, you don't have DHCP. What if your router goes down?
Well, that is true. Then I'm really completely cactus, aren't I? Everything stops.
That's right. And a lot of people, and in fact, this is an interesting thing that happens on power outages and stuff. People forget to turn their router back on, and then they turn all their computers back on, and their computers don't end up with IP addresses, and they can't figure out why not. And then suddenly the halogen goes on, and they realise that there's actually configuration, the DHCP server's on the router.
Kerry, I just thought I might mention, you know, recently we were speaking about wireless channels, and how they, if someone, say, set their router on, say, channel 6, for an example, and if another person's got the same channel, it can interfere. And I had that incident recently where there's 5 routers around us, and they all were set on channel 6.
It's interesting, isn't it, Dean? Because as far as I recollect, when you started this course, there wasn't that many wireless networks around you.
No, there's actually just 8 around as now, where there's only like there was 2 or 3.
Well, in fact, when we moved into our apartment block, we had none. We've now got 2, sometimes 3. We've got Hadro, Optus Home, and Default. There we go. There's somebody who went in and configured their wireless network.
It's surprising how many of them are left open.
Oh, and Big Pond Home. Yeah, you're right. Big Pond. So that's right. So you do really need to check your channel usage and stuff. And there are various channels that overlap. And it's always in your best interests if you can move your wireless network onto a channel that isn't in use by everybody else, if you can find one. And I actually have a piece of software on my EEP called Kismet, which will actually search out and tell me about wireless networks. And given enough packets, it will actually crack web networks as well.
Okay, we're right to continue?
Just one question about the DHCP thing, and then I will stop interrupting. That question is, if I was to set it up on my Linux box, which I should do as an exercise, and I do agree with you, Kerry, at least just for the exercise of it, will I need to disable the one on the router, or can you have 2 sitting on the network?
You won't know which one is actually going to hand out an IP address if you have 2 active at once. And unless the DHCP servers cooperate and the intra DHCP protocol has not been standardised, you can actually have problems with them handing out different IP addresses and different information. So you've got to make sure that if you have 2 devices that are active as DHCP servers, that you make sure that each device hands out consistent information, whatever that may happen to be.
Yep, thanks.
Okay, back to you, Dean. It's all yours.
Okey-dokey. On a Cisco router, the Cisco IOS command show IP route displays the router shows the routes in the routing table. Several types of routes can appear in the routing table. Directly connected routes. When the router powers up, the configured interfaces are enabled. As the interfaces become operational, the router stores the directly attached local network addresses in the connected routes in the routing table. On the Cisco routers, the routes are identified in the routing table with a prefix C for directly connected.
This is vital. You must know these prefixes.
Actually, I'll just run through the prefixes. I just got a little tape. We have C for directly connected, S for static, I for IGRP, R for RIP, M for mobile, B for BGP, D for EIGRP, EX for EIGRP external, O for OSPF, IA for OSPF inter area, and it just goes on and on and on for a couple of other ones as well.
Ah, and then did people know that whenever you do a show IP route, it actually shows you that list at the top of the output?
That's where I cut and pasted it from.
Oh, well, I was just making sure that people didn't think you were, like, super-duper clever there and had, you know, managed to, you know, Google that up. But, yeah, it actually shows up at the top of the list in case you forget them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The routes are automatically updated whenever the interface is reconfigured or shut down. Static routes. A network administrator can manually configure a static route to a specific network. A static route does not change until the administrator manually reconfigures it. These routes are identified in the routing table with the prefix S, as we just spoke about.
Why would you use a static route? Anybody tell me? I'll take that as a no. When you are routing to a stub network that will not change or move, in other words, if you have a network that you know is 192.168.60.0 and it's always going to be 60.0 and it's always connected to one particular router, you put that in as a static route because it is a stub network that is not going to move.
Would that be the same, like you say, whereas you have a point-to-point link, Gary?
Similar. No, the UltraWAP has no routing in it at all, Geraldine. It's actually just a wireless bridge. Yeah, so that's when you'd use them. You can use them for PPP links, but generally the PPP, the route gets added when the interface comes up. Yeah, so you actually use the static routes for stub networks that are connected off and that they're always going to be located in the same place.
Default gateway is always static, isn't it?
No.
I mean, when you configure the default gateway on a device.
No. The default gateway can be learned by RIP or any of the other routing protocols. In fact, one of the labs in CCNA2 actually gets you to get the gateway learned by RIP, which I don't think worked for some people.
No, I think it did.
I think it did. I seem to remember doing that.
It was only some of the labs that were written incorrectly, which didn't help.
It never does.
Do static routes have an advantage over dynamic routes?
Yeah.
Thought that might have been the case.
The advantage of a static route is that it doesn't change. It doesn't need to be learned because it's already hard-coded into the configuration. And the static route is always present. Whereas if you lose connectivity to a network, you can actually lose dynamic routes if the route becomes available. Sometimes that is what you're going to want. Although keep in mind that a static route does not need to be transferred over the network, so that saves on bandwidth. It keeps your routing table size down. And the more dynamic routes you have, the more data needs to be transferred by the routing protocol.
Gotcha.
However, if you have 67 static routes and constant changes to the network, you're going to end up tearing your hair out.
There would be a limit to its advantageousness, but not much.
Yeah, there'd be a limit of its advantageousness depending on the administrative overhead. Imagine if you had 20 routers with 10 static routes per router.
Not fun.
No. And this is the key with this stuff, is you've got to think big. I mean, you might only have one router at home and two subnets, maybe. Most people should really only have one unless they know what they're doing. But if you're dealing with an enterprise, in fact, Gemma can tell stories about this. We were dealing with she doesn't need to, but we were dealing with a council that had about 15 external sites, and we had a couple of routers and stuff, and we had to make sure all of the routes to the different external sites through the wireless bridges and things were actually correctly configured. We had to make sure that they were going to go over to the correct... Well, they were actually wireless routers to the correct router to then be bridged across to the remote site.
Yeah, and at first when they said, oh, we'll just stack them, it's no problem, and then every time they added a new network, they had to put it into every router.
That's right, and they got sick of that really quickly.
And
they
the
were
next
about
week they rang up and said, can we do that dynamic stuff?
Good one.
I still remember standing up in their training room and going through how the network was actually partitioned up and having the IT manager drawing up on the board as I spoke. And when I finished, a bloke up the back called Bill goes, you've got all that in your head? I'm like, yeah, I know. I need a life.
Good on him.
Okay, the next section is dynamically updated routes. Dynamic routes are automatically created and maintained by routing protocols. Routing protocols exchange routing information with other routers in the network. Dynamically updated routes are identified in the routing table with the prefix that corresponds to the type of routing protocol that created the route. For example, R is used for the routing protocol RIP, whether it be RIP 1 or RIP 2, it's still the same. Default route. The default route is a type of static route that specifies the gateway to use when the routing table does not contain a path for the destination network. It is common for default routes to point to the next router in the path to the ISP. If a subnet has only one router, the router is automatically the default gateway because all network traffic to and from the local network has no option but to travel through the router. Routing tables do not contain end-to-end information about the entire path from a source network to the destination network. They only contain information about the next hop along the path. The next hop is typically directly connected network within the routing table.
Did you want me to take over a bit there, Dean? Do you need a drink or something?
It's all right. No, it's just hard to listen to Jaws for each of the paragraphs and then try and stick it in your head.
I know. I did that on Wednesday.
I wish I could do Braille, but anyway, it's not to worry. Anyway, moving right along.
You'd have to sell yourself to science to afford the Braille display. You're doing really well, though, Dean. Insanely well.
He's doing great. A great job, actually.
I've been up all night trying to remember it.
No. I was doing bucket loads of paraphrasing on Wednesday. Don't you worry, Dean, and you are doing so well. It's great.
It must have sounded funny to everybody talking to myself in the middle of the night going over things.
They're probably used to it by now. He probably just wakes up and goes,
remote bundle.
Thanks, everyone.
don't you feel special and unique and stuff, Dean? We make you feel so loved and wanted.
Yeah, I'm just a special guy.
That's for sure.
Anyway, I'll tell you what. Right along.
No worries, off we go.
In the case of a static route, the next hop could be an IP address, any IP address, as long as it is reachable by the router. Eventually, the message gets passed to a router that is directly connected to the destination host, and the message is delivered. Routing information between all intermediate routers on a path is in the form of network addresses, not specific hosts.
Okay, yeah, it's saying the actual routes are actually to network addresses, not specific hosts. So you route to the 192.168.10.0, you don't generally have a route to 192.168.10.57. However, there is one time when you do have a route that points directly to a specific host. Can anybody tell me what that situation is?
Point to point.
That's exactly right. And what's the what's the net mask on a point-to-point ring? Anybody know?
Come on, anybody. /30.
No, it's actually /32. 255.255.255.255.
Hmm.
That's a true point-to-point link, although Cisco does set ones up with /30 by default, because that's the way the Cisco iOS does them, but you can actually do them with a straight /32.
Oh, okay. Hmm, that's something new again.
You had to do them with /30 because your point-to-point routes were actually being distributed by a routing protocol. If you weren't distributing the point-to-point routes with a routing protocol, you would actually set them with a /32.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Yeah, I think if you look at your router, your TPG address will have a subnet mask of 255 as well.
Yes, they do. You're right. They used to do them with the .252, 255, 255, 255, 252, when they were doing RFC 1483 bridging. But then when they moved over point-to-point over Ethernet, what actually happened was that you actually just got enough. I mean, essentially the reason you use /32 is because, say for example, and this is sort of digressing a bit, but it's kind of interesting, so tough. We had Lismore Internet, and we had an IP pool of 203.35.83.0, and we had a Class C. And the dial-up range went from 32 to 128. So when a user dialed into the network, they got assigned an address, say 203.35.83.41. The router then added what we call a proxy ARP entry for 203.35.83.41, and that means that whenever somebody asked for that IP address, the router would answer with its MAC address, and then the router would be responsible for handing the packets on to 203.35.83.41. This meant that when you dialed into a particular access server, one end of the IP address, one end of the link was the IP address of the access server, and this is what we call an IP unnumbered link, which exists on point-to-point links. It's called IP unnumbered, where one end of the point-to-point interface has the IP address of a specific Ethernet interface, and the other end has a one of the IP an address that's pulled out of a pool. And that means you only use one IP address per connected client, rather than using a block of four per connected client. Okay, I've just upset Dean's apple cart there, but that's all right. You go look up proxy ARP if you get bored, and it'll explain how that works.
That's the idea of this course, so I can learn all these different things. Okay, moving right along. It is only in the final router that the destination address in the routing table points specifically to a host computer rather than a network. To configure static routes are manually configured by a network administrator. Configuring static route on a Cisco router requires the following steps.
I think you just about know these off the top of your head, Dean.
Connect to the router using a console cable. And I tell you what's really good is a USB to RS232, like the 9-pin serial connector. They work really good.
Tell you what we got the other day, which is even better, is you can actually get them from eyo.com.au for about $35. It's USB to two RS232 ports.
Yeah, now the one I've got's got the surge protector in it as well. It's got the two ports on it, but I paid about $80 for it, and it ripped off.
Oh, no, if it's got the surge protector in it, you probably didn't, but there are some that you can pay $35 for, and they're two serials. The other thing you can also get, which is worth knowing about, especially for you people who are going to be wandering around administering networks with notebooks, is there are actually a whole series of Express card serial cards and things. So you can use that Express card slot on your laptop that you use for nothing else with the serial card.
Yeah, because a lot of the new laptops and things don't have either serial or parallel ports in them.
Well, parallel printers are like so 1990, I think. I mean, most printers these days have got both parallel and USB on them.
I know a few people that had to get the USB to parallel adapter.
Topaz is snoring, just so that you get that again.
Oh, my lecture is that exciting.
You don't have to know that.
Don't take
I just tell you just to wind you up, Elise, because you hate hearing about the dog snoring.
Oh, no, I just have to comment on it. We just have to know these things.
Okay, moving right along. Step number two, open a hyperterminal or a TerraTerm window to connect to the first router that you want to configure. Step three, enter privilege mode by entering enable at the router prompt, which changes the router prompt from a greater than to a pound or hash symbol that indicates that you're in privilege mode.
Or a noughts and crosses grid, if you're my sister.
However you are identified is the only the best thing.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I'm just saying yes.
Noughts and crosses grid, God grief.
Well, it is a noughts and crosses. And it's also called an octothorpe, which is another weird name for it.
You need to get a life.
Well, there's actually a pronunciation guide for all of the ASCII characters. Look, while you are on the remote bundle not getting a life, I'm on, you know, looking at ASCII characters not getting a life. So each to their own.
Both just as bad as one another. Okay. Step number four
that
is...
You're the ones turn to when they've got problems with their computers, aren't you?
Yeah, and then Gemma is actually editing XML.
I'm doing up bloody HTML pages for Gavi.
Yes, marking up pages or converting text files or something. It's always people who don't have a life are the ones that people run to when they're in trouble with their computer. I've seen it happen
absolutely
time and time again. So we do serve some purpose in the community.
A very important purpose.
Okay, step number four, enter global configuration mode. Can anybody tell me how you enter global configuration mode, apart from Gemma?
Set configure terminal.
It sure is. Mm-hmm. Very good. So we're going to hear. And can anybody tell me what the prompt would be after typing in configure terminal?
You got to know these prompts, guys.
You would end up with the name of the router and config in brackets with a pound or hash sign after it.
Or noughts and crosses grid.
Or Kerry's noughts and crosses grid. Step five. Use the IP route Cisco IOS command to configure the static route with the following format. It's IP route, destination network, subnet mask, and the gateway address. Or you can do it a second way. IP route, destination network, subnet mask, and exit interface.
Question. If you specify the exit interface, what IP address do the packets come from when they are sent over that route? I've got you all flummoxed. The packets
have to be the destination instead of the exit.
That actually be the IP address of the exit interface.
Yeah,
so if you specify the exit interface, the packets come from the IP address of the exit interface.
Okay. And the second way that you can configure it is by typing IP route
No, you did the second one. That was the exit interface one.
Oh, sorry. Just as an example, like if you log on to pod 1 and or pod 2, the serial interface is actually different. It's on pod 1, it's serial 0/0, whereas on pod 2 at Curtin, it's serial 0/0/0.
Which means that if you move your configuration files from one pod to another, you have to make those changes or they will crash and burn.
To enable two-way communication with a host on a network 192.168.16.0, the administrator also configures a static route on router 2.
This is critical. It's all well and good to get packets to come out with a route, but if you don't have a route back, the packets can never come back. And one-way packet delivery isn't often very useful. So if you're routing between two routers, you must have a complementary route on the other router, otherwise the packets won't get back.
Yep, that's absolutely right. Because static routes are configured manually, network administrators must add and delete static routes to reflect any changes in the network topology. On a small network, static routes require very little maintenance.
I had to reboot.
Because they are not there are not many possible changes. In a large network, manually maintaining routing tables could create a lot of grey hair, significantly administration time. For this reason, larger networks generally use dynamic routing rather than static routes. Manually configure and reconfigure static routes. Next section is routing protocols. Routes can change very quickly. Problems with cables and hardware failures can make destinations unreachable through the designated interface. Routers need to be able to quickly update routes in a way that does not depend on the administrator to make the changes manually. Routers use routing protocols to dynamically manage information received from their own interfaces and from other routers. Routing protocols can also be configured to manage manually entered routes. Dynamic routing makes it possible to avoid this time-consuming process of configuring static routes. Dynamic routing enables routers to react to changes in the network and adjust their routing tables accordingly without the intervention of the network administrator. A dynamic routing protocol learns all available routes, places the best routes in the routing table, and removes routes when they are no longer valid. The method that a routing protocol uses to determine the best route is called a routing algorithm. There are two main classes of algorithm: distance vector and link state. Each type uses a different method for determining the best route to a destination network. Whenever the topology of a network changes because of reconfiguration or failure, the routing tables in all the routers must also change to reflect an accurate view of the new topology. For two routers to exchange routes, they must be using the same routing protocol and therefore the same routing algorithm. The distance vector routing algorithm periodically passes copies of the routing table from one router to another. These regular updates between routers communicate topology changes. Distance vector algorithm evaluates the route information it receives from other routers using two basic criteria. Distance, how far away is the network from the router? Vector, in which direction should a packet be sent to reach this network? The distance component of a route is expressed in terms of a cost, route cost, or metric that can be based on the following items: number of hops, administrative distance, bandwidth, transmission speed, likelihood of delays, reliability. The vector.
I was just about to say, how many hops away is that, Skip?
Somebody said too many donuts.
Not me, that'll be Chris.
Oh, sorry, too many hot dogs.
You can never have too many donuts.
You can never have too many hot dogs.
Can anybody tell me what common routing protocol uses hop count for its as part of its metric.
TraceRoute?
No. Yep. So no to TraceRoute, because TraceRoute is actually a utility, and yes to RIP, or Routing Information Protocol. Both versions 1 and 2 use hop count as the route metric.
And I'll get into the details of that directly. The vector or direction component of a route is the address of the next hop along the path to the network named in the route. An analogy for distance vectors are the highway signs found in intersections. A signpost toward a destination indicates the distance that must be travelled to reach the destination. Further down the highway, another sign points toward the same destination, but now the distance remaining that destination is shorter. As long as the distance is shorter, the traffic is on the right path.
Okay, so everybody figure that? You're driving down the road and it says Dean's Place, 20 miles. And brum, 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 you're driving down the highway and there's another sign that says Dean's Place, 10 miles. Brum, 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 and that's all good. And you drive down the house and it says Dean's Place, 40 miles. And you go, oh, bugger. So you turn around, you go back and you drive down, and it goes Dean's Place, 5 miles. And then you drive down a bit further and it says Dean's Place. So that's the sort of thing they're trying to illustrate there. Mm-hmm. Do we have India on today at all?
Is there or not?
No NAB though. Okay.
Is Ruby or Samuel or number for any
Yeah, Ruby's on. And enable. How many are enabled today, enable?
Hi.
Yeah, how many are at enable today?
4.
Excellent. Hello, the four of you at enable today.
Yes, hello to enable.
Hi.
Day.
You're listening.
Ah, oh, that's good.
I'm sure you are. Good. And if... Well, indeed. Yeah, the internet always gives you guys problems. That's why we make recordings. Now, does anybody at Enable know whether you guys receive the DVDs of the virtual machines? Because Ruby and Samuel claim you didn't, and we think you did, but we don't know one way or the other. So can somebody find somebody who's fairly high up in Enable and find out whether Sue's DVDs made it there or not, because it's possible you guys don't have them. But you can find that out after lecture or whatever and let us know. But we just want to know whether you guys got the DVDs full of virtual machines or not.
We will find it out.
Thank you very much, guys. That would be appreciated, because if without those virtual machines, you'll all fail, and that would be very sad. No pressure.
Oh, 8 to 3 days back.
Yeah, no, that's fine, Ruby, but there's a lot of stuff to download. Lots and lots and lots. There's about 1.5 gig to come down for the Windows XP image, and then there's even more for the Windows 2000. So, methinks you'll probably want to get your hands on the DVD, I think. We'll be able to send one out to you, actually, Ruby. We'll see what we can do, and then Samuel can copy yours or something.
Thank you, Terry.
Oh, thanks, Sue. She offered. I'm just relaying here.
Okay, we're continuing on. Each router that uses the distance vector routing communicates its routing information to its neighbours. Neighbour routers share a directly connected network. The interface that leads to each directly connected network has a distance of 0. Each router receives a routing table from its neighbour routers, for example, R2, receives information from R1 and R2, adds a metric. In the case hop, the hop count to show that there is now one more hop to get to the destination network.
And here I was thinking R2 was going to send packets to D2, but not so lucky.
He's on another network. Then R2 sends the new routing table to its neighbours, including R3. This step-by-step process occurs in all directions between neighbor routers. If there's 3 routers linked together and router 3 is connected back to router 1, what would you end up with?
A routing loop.
Very good.
Loop, baby, loop. Check out the packets. Anyway, yeah, they would. They'd go round in a loop. Round and 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 round. Yeah, so you get the idea.
Round like a donut.
Oh.
Someone's obsessed by donuts.
Well, what did I say?
You need to buy Donut King franchise, I think. Any ice clones?
Yeah, Chris likes the ones that are full of cream and custard and stuff.
Ripped off.
Just email them to me, sir.
Okay, continuing on. Eventually, each router learns about the other more remote networks based on the information that it receives from its neighbours. Each of the network entries in the routing table has an accumulated distance vector that shows how far away the network is given in a given direction. As the distance vector discovery process continues, routers discover the best path to the destination networks based on the information they receive from each neighbour.
Now, this is called routing by rumour, and I don't think that term actually appears in the notes here, but basically you rely on the information you've been fed from other routers, and that's actually referred to as routing by rumour in RIP.
The best path is the path with the shortest distance and the smallest metric. Routing table updates also occur when the topology changes, for example, when a new network is added or when a router fails, causing a network to become unreachable. As within the network discovery processes, topology change update process step by step by sending copies of routing tables from one router to another.
Okay. Any questions on that so far?
That's making sense so far.
Now we're at 12:41, so I think what we might do is do RIP, and then I haven't actually looked further down, but once we finish with RIP, we'll keep an eye on how we're going, and you stop when you've had enough, Dean, but we all want to go to lunch at 1, so keep that in mind, Green.
No, I'll just keep going till till whenever you want. Fine with me. You know, let's continue it on next week anyway.
Alrighty, let's do RIP and we'll wander on. And just a note, actually, that most home routers include RIP, either RIP version 1 and RIP version 2, and you'll find out what the difference is as Dean goes on, and that can often be enabled, but for most home users, RIP isn't particularly useful.
Okay, common interior routing protocols. Routing information protocol RIP is a distance vector routing protocol that is used in thousands of networks throughout the world. It was initially specified in RFC 1058. Characteristics of RIP include the following. Is a distance vector routing protocol. Uses hop count as the metric for path selection. Defines a hop count greater than 15 is an unreachable route. Sends routing table contents every 30 seconds. When a router receives a routing update with a change, it updates its routing table to reflect the change. If the router learns a new route from another router, it increases the hop count value by 1 before adding that route to its own routing table. The router uses a local network address of the directly connected router that sent the update as the next hop occurred. After updating its routing table, the router immediately begins transmitting routing updates to inform other networks of the change. These updates, called triggered updates, are sent independently of the regularly scheduled updates that RIP routers forward. Routing Information Protocol RIP. RIP is simple and easy to implement. The advantages make RIP a widely used and popular routing protocol. On the other hand, RIP has several disadvantages. Allows a maximum of 15 hops so that it can only be used for networks that connect no more than 16 routers in a series. Periodically sends complete copies of the entire routing table to directly connected neighbours in a large network. This can cause significant amount of traffic each time there is an update. Converges slowly on larger networks when the network changes. There are two currently versions of RIP, RIP version 1 and RIP version 2. RIP version 2 has many advantages over RIP version 1 and it is usually used unless the equipment cannot support RIP 2. The most significant difference between RIP version 1 and 2 is that RIP version 2 can support classless routing because it includes the subnet mask information in the routing updates. RIP version 1 does not send subnet mask information in the updates, therefore it must use the classful default subnet masks. The next section is Enhanced Interior Gateway Routing Protocol, EIGRP. EIGRP is a Cisco proprietary enhanced distance vector routing protocol. Can anybody tell me what is a disadvantage with a Cisco proprietary routing protocol?
I can have an educated stab at it if you like, Dean.
Yep, please do.
Would it be that you could only use it with other Cisco routers or other Cisco devices?
Yep, that's it in a nutshell. Okay, EIGRP, as I said, is a Cisco proprietary protocol. Enhanced Distance Vector Routing Protocol, EIGRP, was developed to address some of the limitations of the other distance vector routing protocols, such as RIP. These limitations include the use of hop count metric and the maximum network size of 15 hops, whereas EIGRP has a maximum hop count of 224 hops. Hang on, let's just have a little drink.
It's a lot of talking, isn't it?
It certainly is. I forgot what I was up to. Oh, here we are. EIGRP uses a number of metrics, including a configured bandwidth value and the delay encountered when a packet travels a particular route. The characteristics of EIGRP are as follows. Uses a variety of metrics to calculate the cost of the route. Combines next hop and metric features of distance vector protocols with additional database and update features. And as I said, has a maximum hop count of 224 hops, which is far in advance of RIP. Unlike RIP, EIGRP does not rely only on routing table in the router to hold all the information it needs to operate. EIGRP creates two additional databases, the neighbor table and the topology table. Can someone tell me what the two types of topologies are?
Star,
bus and star?
Ready.
No, I'm really referring
to
logical.
Physical and logical?
Yep, that's it. Thanks, Gemma. The neighbor table stores data about the neighboring routers that are on the directly connected networks. This neighbor table includes information such as the interface, IP addresses, interface type, and bandwidth. EIGRP builds the topology table for each of the advertisements of its neighbors. The topology table contains all of its routes advertised by the neighbor routers. EIG depends on a routing algorithm called diffused update algorithm, or DUAL for short, to calculate the shortest path to destination within a network and to install this route into the routing table. The topology table enables a router running EIGRP to find the best alternative path quickly when a network occurs. If no alternative route exists in the topology table, EIGF queries its neighbours to find a new path to the destination. Unlike RIP, which is limited to the small, simple networks of less than 15 hops, EIGRP is ideal for larger, more complex networks up to 224 hops in size that require fast convergence. The next section is link state protocol.
Okay, we're 9 minutes off the end of the lecture. Does anybody want to do link state, or have you all had enough?
Had enough.
Yeah, there's a fair bit in there. I think we might stop there, Dan, because it's fairly heavy. You're doing a sterling job.
Yeah, it's really difficult to get stuck in your head and then...
I tell you what, I wouldn't be surprised if there's smoke pouring out the ears there. I have a fair bit of trouble doing that as well. The fact is that's why Geraldine has a braille display, because it makes life infinitely easier. And I'll have a braille display when Polestar inhuman wear get around to fixing it. And they're very useful for this sort of stuff, because you can actually sit the braille display in front of the HP mini note and read along with the braille display and talk at the same time. Makes life a lot easier.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've got no sensitivity in the ends of my fingers. So I've tried using braille, but I can't, unfortunately.
That is unfortunate.
Yes, it is, because it would expand a lot of avenues out for me if I could.
Any questions before we all run off and eat 600 trays of donuts?
I'd just like to thank everybody for their patience with me doing the lecture today.
No, you did a sterling job.
Absolutely.
No, thank you. You, Dean.
Thanks to you.
Yeah, thank you for delivering it, Dean. And I think it's wonderful that students are given the opportunity to do these.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean.
No, we certainly encourage students to have a go at it, because we don't claim to know everything. We just happen to mark the assessments, just keep that in mind. But we don't claim to know everything. We're quite happy to see other students get up and give a lecture and listen to Geraldine's phone bleat like a pile of sheep. And we also like to see... and in fact, if anybody over there in India wants to give a lecture, you're welcome to, although with the internet reliability that may be a bit of a challenge. But we're certainly willing to see other students give a lecture if they wish to as well, just to
absolutely, it's a great experience.
Or if you're not up for a lecture, do a Thursday chat.
Yeah,
that's right, a Thursday chat.
Well done, Chris.
Kerry, can we just ask the Naval Head how they're getting along with the translations of some of the networking terms?
Enable's probably best to answer that. How are you guys going with all the translation to the various networking terms and stuff? We'll take a rain check on that, I think.